100. I've been trying to sell everyone on this round for years, but the military is slow to move on anything. I'll take your word for it. How did you ever make it through sniper school? Freddy asked in feigned astonishment. I must have had a good spotter, Reese smiled back. Must have, Freddy agreed. Anyway, I doubt we'll do anything super long range, but we have an Accuracy International in 300 Norma, and even a Barrett M10750 if we need it. We've got some belt feds as well as a bunch of anti-armor stuff. Plus, we have demo. He pointed to a row of tubes leaning against the back wall of the room. Law rockets, AT-4s, even a javelin in that case back there. Those things are like a quarter mil a pop, but certainly do the job. Well, I'll be sure to use those sparingly. Reese noticed a row of Ops Corps ballistic helmets fitted with L3 technologies, GPNVG-18 night observation devices, hanging on the wall. The best NODs that money could buy. The devices were easily recognizable thanks to the 4 panoramic lenses that gave the user better peripheral vision than with other models. 4 bangers, huh? That's rich kid shit. Taxpayer money spends easy, man. Those things are so much better than the stuff we used to use. You're kind of a gear snob, Freddy. I like nice stuff, man. What can I say? Chapter 35. It was a 20-minute ride in the Hilux to the range, the wide-open landscape reminding Reese of being back at sea. The mostly flat, sometimes rolling, but always barren terrain made for a perfect training area. A local construction firm had used a bulldozer to create impact berms at various distances. There was a U-shaped berm 100 meters deep for short-range work, and beyond it was a rifle range for shots as far as 1,800 meters. A faded red shipping container served as a supply closet, and its roof gave them line of sight to the sniper targets. There were steel plate targets of various sizes and shapes scattered across the landscape, allowing for shots at just about every conceivable distance. What looked to be an inoperable Mercedes sedan from the 1970s sat inside the perimeter. "Let me guess, that's my ride?" Reese quipped. "Yeah, man, sorry about the windshield. We'll have to get you some goggles." As they parked, Freddy's usually casual tone and body language shifted to all business. "Okay, we'll start with some handgun work, then get you going on the MP7 before moving to the 416s. We can mess with the long-range stuff another day." "Sounds good, buddy." Freddy unlocked the shipping container and swung open the heavy steel doors. Inside were cases of spray paint, assorted cardboard targets, additional steel plates, several cases of ammunition, and pieces of plywood cut into various shapes. "Help me with this barricade." Freddy motioned to a vertical plywood facade with steps down one side and filled with holes of varying shapes and sizes. They carried the mock barricade to the center of the range and set it up next to the Mercedes. "Go ahead and get the kinks out with your 9mm while I get some of this other stuff set up. There's ammo in the back of the truck." Reese nodded and walked toward a row of 3 steel silhouette targets. It occurred to him that the last time he'd fired a handgun, it had been into the mouth of a federal agent responsible for killing his family. It was difficult for his mind to reconcile that act with the fact that he was back in the employ of the United States government. Crazy world. Reese was wearing the SIG 320 in a holster on his belt rather than his usual Black Point tactical mini wing concealment rig. There was no reason to try to conceal a handgun while wearing full battle gear. Skills such as shooting are highly perishable, and Reese hadn't done any serious firearms training in close to a year. Being an expert in anything means doing the basics exceptionally well, so Reese started with the fundamentals. Putting on his ear protection, he took a deep breath to focus. Then, standing 10 yards from a steel plate, Reese drew the handgun from his holster, his left hand meeting the gun at his pectoral muscle as the muzzle rotated toward the target. He pushed the SIG out with both hands, gripping firmly until his elbows nearly locked, pressing the trigger as he drove the gun swiftly toward the target. His eyes met the front sight just as the trigger broke, and his brain recognized the instant gratification of a center mass hit on the steel target as the gun recoiled slightly upward. Keeping his trigger finger on the trigger, he scanned to the left and right of his target before moving his finger to the frame to look behind him for threats, before replacing the handgun in his holster. Situational awareness. He drew again, a bit faster this time, and put two rounds into the target in quick succession. He repeated the process until the magazine ran dry, performed a slide lock reload, stepping to his left, and fired two more rounds. He moved farther from the targets and began engaging multiple plates in rapid succession, quickly transitioning from one to the next. Speed came back quickly thanks to hundreds of thousands of rounds fired over the past 18 years during similar training sessions. He had burned his way through 10 magazines when he saw Freddy watching him over his left shoulder during one of his post-target scans.
"Just like riding a bike, looking sharp, Reese."
"Thanks. Feels good to be back at it."
"I bet. Let me paint these targets and we'll get dialed in on the fun gun."
Freddy shook a rattle can of spray paint as he approached the targets that were covered with the gray splatters of Reese's pistol rounds. He recoated them with glossy white paint and waved for Reese to follow him to a folding table with the suppressed MP7 and a row of loaded magazines. Freddy picked up the tan and brown camouflaged submachine gun and pointed the muzzle skyward.
"Okay, Reese, this will be a new toy for you. This thing shoots really fast and has almost no recoil. It's also exceptionally quiet with serious penetration, so if the bad guys are wearing armor, it's a better choice than a handgun. We started using them at Dam Neck, and a lot of guys fell in love with them."
Freddy retracted the small stock to its rear position and folded down a stubby grip below the barrel.
"You can shoot it like a handgun in a pinch, but you won't hit much. The mags go in the grip like an Uzi and hold 40 rounds. You cock it here, and the selector is here,"
he demonstrated, handing the firearm to Reese.
"It might look like it works like the old MP5, but that's just because it's an HK. It'll operate like an M4 from your perspective. Have at it. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast."
"I've heard that somewhere before," Reese said, remembering the old SEAL adage. Reese loaded a magazine into the hollow grip and moved the safety selector to semi-auto. His eye quickly found the crisp red dot of the aimpoint microsight, and he pressed the trigger. The shot was totally underwhelming, with almost no discernible recoil and minimal report, reminding him of the pellet rifle his grandfather had given him as a kid. A single tiny speck of gray was visible at the center of the target 30 meters away. He flipped the selector to full auto and leaned a bit harder into the gun to control its rise. Reese tried for a short burst, and five or six suppressed rounds spat from the muzzle, pinging against the steel target downrange. The gun barely moved. He fired a longer burst, 10 or so rounds, and was amazed by how controllable the little gun was. He emptied the remainder of the magazine into the target in a longish string, and all 24 rounds stayed in the 8-inch circle. He turned to his friend, grinning ear to ear.
"I like it. I knew you would. It has its limitations, but it's definitely useful."
Reese spent a few minutes familiarizing himself with his new toy before Freddy began running him through some basic drills with it. He held an electronic shot timer that would measure Reese's reaction time from the buzzer to his first round on target. Freddy set up orange traffic cones on the range and had Reese navigate them in various ways as he engaged the targets, shooting while moving forward, backward, and laterally, and ultimately shooting while weaving through the cones like a sports car on a slalom course. Gunfights aren't static events, and perfecting the skill of shooting while moving could mean the difference between life and death. They fired from various positions over, under, and through the plywood barricade, and practiced using the junk Mercedes for cover. After hours of work with the handgun, MP7, and HK416 carbines, it was time for a breather. They broke for lunch and talked as they ate gyro-like sandwiches on the tailgate of the Hilux. Reese opened the paper wrapper and looked at the contents
as if the food was booby-trapped. "They put mayo on these things?" he asked in disgust. "You and your mayo. I'd forgotten about that phobia. Wonder if there's a scientific name for it. It's so nasty." "Fear not, Reese, no mayo. It's some kind of yogurt sauce." Visibly relieved, Reese took a tentative bite. His face lit up in approval. "You always were a natural, Reese. It kills me that I eat and sleep this stuff and you just stroll out here and shoot like a champ." Reese shrugged as he chewed a bite full of lamb and pita. "Should I sandbag a little to make you feel better?"
"Ha! No, dude. Keep it up. The sooner we get this done, the sooner we can get back to our families."
Freddy paused for a second, catching himself.
"Sorry, bro. Didn't mean it like that. I forgot.
It's okay. Seriously, stop apologizing. You're a dear friend and a great dad. No need to apologize."
"I'm just sorry, man. With all of the challenges we have with Sam, at least I can hug him when I get home."
"I admire the hell out of you and Joni. You guys never complain, never ask for anything. You just get it done."
"You play the cards you're dealt, Reese. That's all you can do. When you look at the statistics of families dealing with special needs kids, the odds are that the added stress breaks you apart. For some reason, it made us a closer, more compassionate family. It made us a team."
"Never look at the odds, buddy. My hat is off to you guys.
Now, let's go train so you can get home to see them."
After lunch, both men strapped on their heavy chest rigs, harnesses of nylon webbing laden with body armor, gear, and loaded magazines. They spent the afternoon working as a team, perfecting the choreography of shooting, moving, and communicating. They began at a walking pace and progressed rapidly to full speed. If one of them was moving or reloading, the other was putting rounds on the target. By day's end, they were doing it seamlessly and without words. When the sun went below the horizon, they attached NODs to their helmets and repeated the drills in darkness, their infrared lasers painting the targets invisible to the naked eye. The only sounds came from the hard ground crunching beneath their boots and the suppressed gunshots from their muzzles. To the two professional commandos, who had spent more than half of their lives working at night, both in training and on combat deployments, their actions were as natural as breathing.
Chapter 36. Iraq-Syria Border. August. Lieutenant Colonel Saeed had received the encrypted message on his phone the previous evening and had spent the day planning and coordinating. He'd picked 15 of his best men and called it in as a training mission. An Mi-8 from their air wing, flown by Iraqi pilots trained to fly with NODs over the pine forests of the Florida Panhandle, courtesy of the CIA, took off under the cover of darkness and flew them to this rendezvous site. As the men waited in the darkness, they smoked and checked weapons and gear, joking with one another, just like every group of soldiers in history. Saeed loved his men and observed them with both pride and sadness. To many, it would seem odd for an Iraqi Special Operations commander to be handing his troops over to work under a former general in the Syrian army, but to Saeed, nothing was strange anymore. Times were simpler under Saddam, when ruthless loyalty to the Ba'ath Party and its leaders was all that it took to thrive. Following the 2003 invasion, Saeed had worked for the Americans and then the inept and corrupt government they'd left behind in their hasty departure. He'd fought ISIS as they swept across much of the only country he'd ever called home, and watched with even more confusion as they were beaten back by the Iranian-influenced Shia militias and the Kurds, who were still allied with the Americans. Would he work for the Turks next? The Iranians? Who knew? He would serve nearly any master so long as they were in power. That's how you lived in a place like Iraq. It had always been all about survival for him and his family. Side jobs, such as this one that had brought him to the middle of the desert, would help ensure that he had the resources to someday move his family to a safer place. One of his men spotted the trucks driving in complete darkness across the flat, desert terrain. This was his cue to leave. He hugged each one and bid them farewell, hopeful that he would see them again.
"Captain Daraji,"
Saeed said, motioning to the officer in charge.
"Yes, Colonel. You will be picking up two local assets when you land. Their handler will be briefing them up. For them, it is about the cause. For us, it is about payment."
"Understood, Colonel," Daraji said, snapping a smart salute.
"Ma'al salama."
"Fi aman Allah,"
Saeed responded, returning his subordinate's salute. As Saeed boarded the now empty cargo bay of the helicopter, he asked his creator to watch over them. He didn't need to wait around to see what would happen next. His men would board the trucks and be driven into Syria to a military airfield under Assad's control, where they and their gear would be transferred to an AN-26 cargo aircraft. This twin-engine workhorse was built in the former Soviet Union and could serve as everything from a flying hospital to a bomber. It lacked the range to reach their destination on a single tank of fuel, so they would fly over the Mediterranean Sea until they refueled at a remote airstrip in the failed state of Libya. From then, God willing, it was on to the target.
Chapter 37. Redacted, Black Site, near Redacted, August. Reese knew he was almost out of air. Despite his attempts to stay calm, his heart raced, eating up precious oxygen. His world had darkened at the edges of his vision due to the suffocation. He was in trouble, and he knew it. He was suddenly with his father, hiking a steep, muddy trail canopied by the thick vegetation of North Carolina's Nantahala National Forest. His father's career in what they thought was the Foreign Service meant long periods of separation, so Reese cherished the time they spent together. They'd walked down a twisting, narrow path to a surging waterfall, hidden miles from the nearest highway. The steady rains in these mountains provided a constant source of creek water that had worn the rocky face so smooth that you could actually slide down part of the falls in the seated position and splash into the deep pool at the bottom. It was a place where people had gathered long before any Europeans had stepped ashore in the New World, and it was still special. The heavens opened, and within seconds they were drenched from an abrupt deluge of rain. Their respite from the summer heat had become a shivering battle for warmth. His father took a look at his son, whose face was a mask of misery, and decided that they would hike back to the Wagoneer at the trailhead, which meant a steep and muddy climb in the torrential downpour. James's little legs powered along as best they could, attempting to match his father's long and powerful stride.
"Come on, Jamesy, you can do it, buddy. Just put one foot in front of the other."
James wasn't about to let his father or himself down. He'd climb three steps forward and slide two steps back in the slick brown ooze that the trail had become, but kept moving forward, his legs feeling like jelly. Thomas Reese wiped the crystal of the faded steel dive watch on his wrist.
20 more minutes and we're back at the car, James. Just don't quit, buddy. Life is hard sometimes, but if you stay with it and keep moving forward, you'll prevail. Trust me."
Reese kept hiking, maintaining a stiff upper lip and a stride that mimicked his father's gait. He tripped over twisted roots on the trail, his muddy sneakers squished brown water with each step, but he pressed on.
"You've got it, son. Never quit."
He wasn't going to quit. Reese was suddenly back in the present, sweat stinging his eyes. He struggled to free himself, but the hold was too strong, the other man's legs locking his neck in a delta of flesh and muscle and restricting the flow of blood and oxygen to his brain. His opponent was on his back with one hand pulling Reese's right arm across his body and the other pulling downward on his head. The man's right thigh was pressed against one side of his neck,